There's something enchanting, I think, especially to children, a story that has to do with a man who has been framed, a man who has been condemned to be thrown to the hungry lions, who has an angel of God come down and shut the mouth of the lions so that he survives the night and yet lives in the morning. And then quite brutally to see his enemies, those who tried to frame him, cast to the fate that they wanted for him. There's something, again, enchanting and strikes our imagination about that story, perhaps that appeals to children. And in the title of the lesson, I spoke of children's stories with adult messages. I preached on this sort of a theme before in talking about Noah. But there are certain stories from the Bible that lend themselves to the imaginations of children. And we teach them and we create a lot of visual aids for them to try to appreciate the fullness of a story like that of Daniel being thrown to the lions. And so there might be something especially of interest to those that are younger as we talk about this particular episode from the Old Testament this morning. But let me also say that I don't think God told the story of Noah or the story of David and Goliath or the story of Samson or the story of Daniel or any other stories particularly to appeal to children. That they appeal to children is a good thing. And I think it's a portal of interest into the Scriptures. But I think there are adult themes that are wrapped up in those stories. There are principles that challenge those of us who have perhaps been Christians for a while. And we examine our faith and we question our commitment to the Lord and we read a story like this and perhaps are caused to ask ourselves some probing and penetrating questions. I want to begin by just considering briefly the historical background of the book of Daniel. I do think sometimes we can tend to have this problem. I think the teachers here work hard probably to overcome this. But we might teach these children stories to those of younger age without connecting them. That they just sort of float out there independent in space somewhere. And we might not know as young folks really where they fit into the whole scheme of the story. And I think it's important to understand the historical background of various stories in the Bible so that we understand the principles perhaps that might be lying underneath. But by the time we read about Daniel in Daniel chapter 6, again that's page 601 in the Pew Bible if you're following along in that, Daniel is a Jew, but he doesn't live in Canaan or Palestine. He actually dwells, as I have marked somewhere, around the area of the Red Star. It's hard to tell exactly where chapter 6 takes place, but it is within the realm of the Persian Empire. But Daniel has been taken captive as a young person and has been living the vast majority of his life. First of all, under Babylonian rule. And now that the Babylonians have been supplanted by the Medes and the Persians, he lives under Persian rule. And this places the story that we read about relative to Daniel in the mid-500s B.C., which actually is toward the end of the Old Testament history. There are a few books like Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther that'll come historically after Daniel. But Daniel really is sort of at the tail end of what's been happening in the Old Testament. As a young man and taken captive, and by taken captive, don't skip over that part too quick. There's a lot of meaning in that. Ripped from his family, taken out of his homeland and away from everything familiar, not just taken away, but he looks in his rearview mirror and sees everything being destroyed in his homeland. Taken away from his religion, taken away from the Scriptures. He is quite literally and viciously jerked out of his homeland and stuck over here in the middle of a heathen society. And early in the book of Daniel, we see that he's becoming trained to serve as an administrative official in the Babylonian Empire. And Daniel's pretty good at it. Of course, he's blessed by God, but that's not apart from his character and his ability that he naturally has. And so he begins to rise in the administration of the Babylonians, and by some help from God and interpreting dreams and some other things that happen, Daniel acquires a very high place of power and rule among the Babylonians. And he does the same thing after the Babylonians are overrun by the Medes and the Persians. Again, his character causes him to rise to the top, and he's blessed by God again. And he comes to note among the Persian rulers. By the time we get to Daniel chapter 6, Daniel is a very old man. And I don't know if that's always reflected in the Bible class material or the pictures that we see drawn of Daniel, but he's probably approaching 80, if not in his 80s at this time. He's been around a long, long time. He served God for a long time, and that's going to become very important as we consider the deeper implications of the story. But what happens to Daniel, and all of the good and laudable things we can say about Daniel relative to his faith, occur in a book. I'll show you some of that. They occur in a book that actually reflects on the power of God. The fact that Daniel's been taken into captivity along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and a lot of other Jewish youths and most of the people early on and eventually all of the people, the fact that this story happens in the context of the decline of Judah and the overthrow of the people of God really is being told for this primary reason: to reflect on the power and the greatness and the control of God over human events. Because what's going to happen because of these historical events, doubt is going to arise in the mind of the people that God really had the power to stop this in the first place. People forgetting that God is the one who caused this to happen because of the unfaithfulness of the people. He had been warning them and warning them and warning them through prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and many others what he was going to do if the people would not repent. And he told there was going to be a people to come from the north, a people that speak a strange language and take the people out of the land. And sure enough, that's exactly what God causes to happen. And lest someone think that those original conquerors were superior to God, or their gods were superior to Jehovah, we have a book like Daniel that continues to show us the power and the control of God, even over the conquering nation. And so we read stories like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being thrown into the fire, but God preventing them from being hurt because they wouldn't bow down to the image of Nebuchadnezzar. We read about Nebuchadnezzar becoming very proud of himself, thinking that by his own power he had built this great city of Babylon, and God takes away his sanity and causes him to live as a wild animal for a period of an indeterminate amount of time, seven periods, maybe years. But nonetheless, God is demonstrating to the Babylonians, he later demonstrates to the Persians, and will demonstrate to Darius in this story, you may have my people in captivity, but I still rule. And I don't only rule them, I rule you too. I rule over all the heathen kingdoms of the world, not just my people. And so while it's a wonderful story here in Daniel chapter 6 of Daniel surviving the lion's den, the deeper principle, I think, for us to understand is God is in control. And he uses the treachery intended against Daniel to prove it. Let's read verses 1 through 17. We've already read the outcome of the story. We've let the cat out of the bag, but I think you knew the outcome anyway. But let's read what led up to Daniel being cast into the den of lions. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. Over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom and the administrators and satraps and the counselors and the advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree." Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. "Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter." So they answered and said before the king, "That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you've signed, but makes his petition three times a day." And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed." So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." Then a stone was brought, laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. There are three key elements, I think, that we read here of the plot that is laid against Daniel. The first of these is the jealousy of Daniel's colleagues as he excels to a higher position. We read that the king wanted to set him over all of the other governors and the satraps because he had proven himself to be so competent and so faithful. This, of course, as happens so often in our own world, breeds jealousy and envy among others who wanted the position for themselves. And so they hatch the plot that we've just read about. In verse 13 of chapter 6, you notice something about their attitude toward Daniel. When they come to the king to tattle, they say, "That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah," otherwise known as a racial slur, is what that was. They pull out the hammer of racial prejudice and begin to bang on Daniel's reputation. This after he had spent his whole life faithfully serving the Babylonians first, faithfully serving now the Persians and Darius personally. And all these people can think to do is drag out a racial slur. That, one of those captives, there's not one of us. We want to tell you what he's been doing. And so we see, and by the way, did you catch as we read, or perhaps have you thought before of some of the similarities between this and Jesus? Some of the same attitudes are in play here. Pilate knew that because of envy, Jesus had been delivered up. Just a little too popular, that Jesus. Just a little too high and mighty for our own good. So let's find a way to get rid of him. See, human nature doesn't change. This is 500 plus years before Jesus. And I'm going to tell you the same things happened in our lives 2,000 years after Jesus. This is a great study in human nature. It reveals things about God, as we've already said. But it's a wonderful study in human nature. And so here, the jealousy of Daniel's colleagues really is the driving force behind the events that we read about here. But added to that, though, is the role that Darius plays himself. Darius is full of vanity and short-sightedness, and he's duped into signing a law that only he could be petitioned for a month. Now, to Western ears, this sounds really peculiar, because we don't know what it's like to live under an Oriental potentate. And we don't usually think of our government officials as being gods. They may think of themselves sometimes that way, but we don't normally attribute divine status to them. But these people did. These people thought that their rulers were manifestations of God among them. Thus, when the ruler gave a decree, I mean, I've always read the story and said, why couldn't he just turn around and break it? He's the king. But you see, if you think you're God, and the people think you're God, they think that you make a decree and it's absolute and perfect. How do you go back on the thing that you just enacted when you're supposed to be a God? But Darius is so full of himself that he is blind to what's going on. He gets his eyes opened, all right, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's Darius's own vanity, really, that's a necessary component to this particular story. The third element, though, that really makes the story come together is the faith of Daniel. Daniel's convictions were so strong that his enemies knew that he would disobey the law that they had enacted in order to obey his God. Daniel was so predictable, he was so consistent in his behavior, that it enabled them to set the trap because they knew what he would do. And so, the enemies of Daniel are very shrewd. They figure out a way to enact a law that draws on the vanity of Darius and draws on the faithfulness of Daniel to find some sort of a charge that can be laid against Daniel. So there are the key elements, I think, of the plot. Let's talk about just very briefly three overall observations in the story, and then we're going to talk about some others in a little bit more detail. But of the enemies of Daniel, let's notice this particular point. And this is sort of the cart before the horse, or the horse after the cart, or whatever. But at the end of the story, as was read earlier, in verse 24, the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them and their children and their wives. And the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. That's the other side of the rule of an Oriental potentate. Not only does he think he's God, and the people think that he's God, he had absolute power. And he could do with you what he wanted. And he does in this story. But the point is, so often in this life, we think we're getting away with something. But sooner or later, our sins will find us out. And the Old Testament is full of such stories. Cain, Achan, Nabal, Haman, Daniel's enemies. Others you could probably think of as well to add to the list. People that in the end, their transgressions and their sinful ways brought them to an inglorious end. This world is not the time or the place of all retributive judgment of God. Sometimes, as we learn in the Bible, the wicked do prosper and live pretty happy lives in terms of this world's standards. But whether in this world or not, but especially in the day of judgment, our sins are going to find us out. And we're not going to get away with it forever. We're going to have to face the music at some point in our lives. Secondly, I want you to think about Darius again. Like the enemies of Daniel, we must consider the consequences of our actions. Darius was so self-absorbed that he did not perceive the wicked motives of the other officials. He didn't think through the nature of the law that was enacted. And I, you know, you can probably, without too much difficulty, put yourself in Darius' shoes. And, you know, you're talking about a kingdom that's a mixture of people, which I think is behind the image back in Daniel 2 that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to build and commanded all people throughout the empire to bow down to the image. What is this empire? It is a conglomeration of conquered peoples. And these rulers ruled over sometimes very fragile coalitions of conquered people. People that wouldn't necessarily feel warm and fuzzy about you for what you did to their home country, what you did to their family and friends. So anything that you could do to draw attention to yourself and gain the loyalty of the people and cause everybody to look at you in a favorable way, you're going to take it. You want this association of conquered peoples to be bound together, cemented together. And then you take somebody that's a little bit vain and probably insecure to start with, because you don't know who's going to stab you in the back next. All these counselors come and say, you know, we've talked to all the rulers across the land. We all agree we need to honor you for a month. Pretty strong individual to turn that honor down, especially when you're concerned about the cohesiveness of your kingdom. Boy, does Darius fall into that. I mean, lock, stock, barrel, he doesn't stop to think about any of the consequences other than I'm going to get to be honored by the whole kingdom for a whole month. Sometimes things that look really, really wonderful have a bomb hidden inside of them. We need to stop and carefully examine opportunities that come, events that unfold that look like they're just, that's the ticket. Boy, that's the thing I just need to happen to me. And without stopping and carefully considering where this is taking me, we just swallow the whole thing. And of course, that's exactly what Darius does. Darius didn't see what his enemies were up to, but I want to tell you something. The enemies didn't see how Darius was going to react when this whole thing was over either. They're both intent on getting what they want, and neither side stops and thinks about the consequences. Yeah, they knew Darius could be duped by his vanity, but they didn't stop to think about his retribution. And he had the last laugh in this story. Another point to think about relative to Daniel. His honor, competence, loyalty gained the confidence of this heathen king. Daniel, in fact, in verse 22, says to the king, I have done no wrong before you. Of course, Darius knew that. He knew Daniel was an honorable and trustworthy and loyal servant. But look at the expression of a heathen king, even as Daniel is being led to the den of lions. And really, I think verse 16 is probably less a statement of confidence and more of a wish. Your God, whom you serve continually, Daniel, He will deliver you. How confident do you think Darius was in that? Who paced the floor all night? Who couldn't sleep? Who was there at the break of dawn crying out, lamenting, the passage said, Daniel! Daniel! That's how well Daniel had reflected on God. So perhaps we might think of ourselves and ask ourselves, how well have we reflected on the name of God among those that we associate at work, at school? Do even our enemies know how dependable we are relative to our faith? And have we won over and spoken well for God among those that might be more amenable to morality and spirituality? Well, some other things I'd like to notice with you about the story here. Go back to verse 4, chapter 6. When it's proposed that Daniel be set over all of the others, says in verse 3, because there was an excellent spirit within him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. The governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault in him. What if the congressional subcommittee investigated your life? You know, that's the price politicians pay in our day and time, is your enemies on the other side of the aisle get a burr under their saddle and they start investigating your campaign contributions and expenditures, your tax records, how well you have discharged your responsibilities, whether or not you directed FEMA properly during the floods in New Orleans or whatever. I mean, we see this going on all the time. Who leaked the name of the CIA agent, you know, covert agent, blah, blah, blah. We see people in our own country undergoing intense scrutiny by their enemies. This happens to Daniel. After a lifetime of public service, now they're probing into all of his records. And you know what they find? Zip. Nothing. There is nothing that they can put their hands on and bring to the king and say, you can't set this man over the whole kingdom. Look at this. There was nothing against Daniel. Nor, and you look at verse 4 again, they could find no charge or fault concerning the kingdom. That is, they looked into his work records. But then it says, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Could I withstand this kind of scrutiny? It's hard enough to withstand the scrutiny of men. I mean, we can put people through the ringer when we want to, finding out every skeleton in their closet. But what about when God turns His spotlight on me? What's going to be found out about me then? You know, we can get away with it sometimes before men, but we can't get away with it before God. It's very uncomfortable. And probably a reason why a lot of people in our nation don't pursue public service. You know the scrutiny is going to come. And it's not going to be friendly. It's not your friends looking into your resume. It's your enemies. And yet Daniel's integrity survives that kind of scrutiny. How consistent is our devotion to God? Can our enemies count on it? Look again at verse 5. Then these men said, when they struck out against his work record and his personal record, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Daniel's enemies, again, knew how consistent he was and how genuine he was in his faith toward God. The question for us again is, do our opponents see us day in and day out as consistent? Or might we, based on the circumstance, vacillate or bob and weave back and forth, and maybe one day we do and one day we don't. One day we object to the dirty joke in the office, the next day we just sort of let it pass and chuckle. So I don't feel like fighting the battle today. You know, I just don't want people hounding me today. So we just don't react, perhaps the way we did yesterday or last week. I mean, is there a consistency that if your car is in the driveway on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, that the neighbors perhaps know something is wrong? Because that's just completely out of the routine. I know where she is. I know where he is. I know what to expect when something happens in the office or at school. And believe you me, people are watching. And what an example Daniel sets under the most difficult conditions of being consistent before God to the point that a plot can be laid against him. And his enemies know that Daniel will do what he in fact does as the edict not to pray to anyone else is issued. I want you to think about this point as well. Daniel would not compromise to save his own life. The law was passed, and you know, he didn't reason, well, you know, I can be of more help to God alive than I can dead. And I've been praying all my life. You know, what's the big deal about skipping a month? God knows who I am anyway. You know, Daniel didn't engage in any of that kind of rational rationalization. But I want to add another little element to that. He was found so favorable in the eyes of Darius that Darius was going to set him over the whole kingdom. You think it might have been tempting for Daniel to not want to fail Darius personally? He had been so favored by Darius and given such a privilege. Have you ever found yourself in that kind of situation? Somebody has blessed you in some way, or somebody's done a favor for you. They've given you some kind of consideration. And now, to be true to God, you've got to kind of go against that person that you value and you trust, and who's a benefit and a blessing to you. You see, sometimes we might be more prone to be faithful to God if the issue is only between ourselves and God, and cave in when there's a consequence perhaps to a human being that we favor, someone we love, someone we care about. I think very likely there was a temptation here on Daniel's part to not want to fail Darius and the confidence Darius had showed in him. But that does not change Daniel's behavior. Fourth, trying to do what is right will not insulate us from evil. Jesus, of course, has been warning his disciples about that as we've been studying. You're going to go do my will. You're going to be fishing for men. You're going to be issuing the truth of God by inspiration of the Holy Spirit. You're going to be doing all this, and the result's going to be your friends are going to turn you into the authorities. You're going to be alienated from your family. You're going to be brought before magistrates and kings, and some of you are going to be executed. There is not a tie between doing what is right and having favorable outcomes in life. In fact, it's sometimes the opposite. Doing what is right is the reason that you're not going to be treated well, as in the case of Daniel. We do not get a free pass at some point in life because we've been faithful. Again, Daniel's probably pushing 80 or in his 80s, been faithful his whole life, and done everything right and had a stellar record. One, from a human standpoint, might think, well, surely, you know, Daniel would get a free pass with his history. No, doesn't happen that way. Lest we think that because we've been faithful for a while, things ought to smooth out as we get older, we need to understand that sometimes as we get older, it's exactly the opposite that happens, and the stresses and the strains of life get greater. The challenges get greater. We begin to have more anxieties and fears about things. We live long enough to see what can happen to people, what can happen to us, what can happen to our families. You see, as you age, you don't necessarily and automatically just get stronger. It's going to come through effort and study and worship and doing the things that make us strong. It's not an automatic feature of getting older. Like Abraham, Daniel's greatest challenge comes late in life. But I think it comes as God governs these things, when God knows what Daniel can handle. And he knew what Abraham could handle when he said, take your son, your only son Isaac, out and offer him as a burnt offering. He didn't say that to Abraham as a young man. He said it to Abraham as an old man. The challenges often get greater the older we get. Here's the last point I want to consider with you. You know, when we read these Bible stories from a long time, you know, from their standpoint in the future, and we look back at these things, we tend to see the lives of Bible stories, or other historical figures for that matter, we tend to see them in light of the little episodes that we know about their life. And we forget that these men and women of the past lived one day at a time just like we do. Every day that came, they had to get up, shake off their sleepiness, get dressed, eat breakfast, start the day, and then they had to make choices all through that day. And then the next day, they had to do the same thing. And then the next day, the same, and the next day, the same, and the next day, the same. And boredom was a part of these people's lives. Routine was a part of their lives. But we go back and we read certain stories like David facing Goliath. And we think, well, David must have done that every day. No, he didn't do that every day. Every day, David was out with sheep. And occasionally, as he said, a lion or a bear would come along, and I had to fight them off. But, you know, David was a shepherd. Daniel got up and went to work every day and dealt with figures. I would take it by some things that are said. He probably was more of an accountant, keeping up with the administration of the affairs, and that meant oftentimes the money that came into the kingdom. I'm sure a lot of Daniel's life was sheer boredom and repetition. But interwoven into that daily living of Daniel was due consideration for God and praying every day and establishing a relationship with God every day. So that when the trial came, Daniel didn't change a thing. The law changed, but Daniel didn't change. The danger to Daniel changed, but Daniel's prayers and his worship and service to God didn't change. And Daniel, after the edict was passed, just kept on doing what Daniel always did. He couldn't do anything else. And brethren and friends, that's what's important about establishing your faith and building your faith day by day by day when nothing special is going on. You're just grinding along through the routine. And it might be in those times you just sort of let things slide spiritually because no great threat today. Things seem pretty stable in my life. All the kids are well. Job is secure. The retirement's building. I mean, everything's okay. Maybe I don't need to work so hard on my faith. But Daniel, I'll tell you something else. Daniel had no guarantee that we read about in the Scriptures. Daniel had no guarantee that he'd be spared from the lion. And here again, we look at this story after we know the outcome. Put yourself in Daniel's sandals. And you're the one being led out, and you knew it was coming. You knew what your colleagues were up to. You knew the law was passed. You knew when you went home and prayed they'd be watching. You knew they would report it, and you knew the day would come you'd be brought to the den of lions. And now it's you walking toward apparently the upper hole in the cave or whatever this was, the den where the lions were to be thrown in. What are you thinking? What would you be thinking? You don't know if God's going to spare you or not. But you know what? That really isn't germane. It really isn't germane to the issue. As Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said before this when they were thrown into the fiery furnace. Whether we're spared or not isn't the point. The point is my faith and doing what is right, and letting God take care of the consequences. We sang a song or two about that this morning. One in particular, day by day. If we're doing what God wants us to be doing, serving Him and growing, He's going to take care of us day by day. That may mean we die. In fact, we live long enough, we're going to die. It may mean we die in persecution. God didn't spare every faithful servant of His that was threatened because of their fidelity to Him. Daniel was spared because it reflected on God primarily. It demonstrated God's power. Because when the enemies were thrown into the lion's den, as the story is told here, the bodies didn't even reach the bottom before the lions had broken their bones and torn them into pieces. The lions did not refused to eat Daniel because they weren't hungry. They were hungry. But God protected Daniel and shut the mouths of the lions. But does that matter? I mean, does it matter if God shuts the mouth of a lion or whether He allows the lion to do what lions normally do? Does that have any bearing on our faith? It shouldn't. And it won't if we're building our faith day by day by day, because it's only then, when the moment of crisis comes, that we'll be able to respond faithfully. Daniel did what Daniel always did. crisis didn't change that. How strong is your faith in God? Day in and day out, through the boring routine of life, are you ready for the crisis? Because sooner or later it will come. And will we be found as faithful as someone like Daniel when that moment comes? We want to extend to you the invitation of the Lord to come to Him in faith and in obedience. If you're not a child of God, to devote your life and your soul and all that you are to Him. That's what God is asking. He's not asking for us to come and do a few things for Him. He's asking for our soul and our spirit to be devoted to Him and to Him first, even as an Old Testament saint like Daniel did. Can we help you in any way? We're going to stand and sing a song. If we can be of service to you in spiritual things, would you come as we stand and sing?